This is the Lattice Training Podcast, where we bring you the best in climbing performance and training from the world's elite athletes, thought leaders, and coaches. Following on from our recent interview with training legend Eric Hurst, I'm psyched to get onto the Lattice Podcast, yet another major contributor from climbing rehab, training, and performance. This being Tyler Nelson from the USA, aka Camp 4 Human Performance. Many people are probably familiar with Tyler's content via his Instagram page, which has been putting out loads of thought-provoking content for quite a few years now, so much so that I personally took a visit to go and see him in his clinic in Salt Lake a few years back. And what I was really struck with was that when I visited him in person, he had a total passion for being prepared to explore new approaches, had a fascination with evidence-based practice, and pretty much an unstoppable energy for trying anything and everything to do with climbing and performance. And this was super appealing to me because Lattice has a very similar way of doing things. And so I wanted to sit down with Tyler today and get his thoughts on three main topics, which I hope you listeners will find of value. That's one, which sports away from climbing does he draw his knowledge from? And what does he think the nuances of doing this are? Two, what are climbers currently doing that concern him and how they could do better with their training or performance? And three, what is the future of the use of training and assessment tools, gadgets, etc.? Because you will have seen Tyler playing around with metric force plates and BFR equipment and all sorts of different things on his Instagram page. So without further ado, welcome Tyler. Psyched to get chatting.
Yeah. And thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, I think it's kind of been like 3-4 years since we saw each other in person and we ended up chatting about all sorts of different things. But one thing that I don't think I really kind of asked you about when I saw you in person last time was a little bit about your early career, as I think you graduated in sports and exercise science and you specialized in tendon loading, connective tissue health, and then ended up working in college athletics. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I went to, that's what my master's degree is in. And then actually went to chiropractic school, which is very similar in the first 2 years to like what medical students get in the States. But then it diverges into weird things at chiropractic school where medical school goes into like pharmacology and medicine and they specialize, et cetera. So I had the chance to do both at the same time, which I did, not with the intention of doing the literal chiropractic side, but more on the like the medical side. But I was always just interested more in sports science and exercise physiology. And so a lot of my initial interest comes from just pretty much any application of sports science to sports, right? Because our physiology is really what I'm interested in, the principles of, you know, how loading influences things, right? And just applying them in different contexts is really what sports scientists do.
And at the time when you were at university studying, were you a climber? So you came at it with that specific view, you know, sort of worldview in terms of that application of sports science, or were you yet to become a climber at that age?
No, I started climbing when I was in college, when I was like maybe 20. And so I originally went to college to play baseball. That's like, grew up playing sports my whole life, and then moved to college and met some friends that were into climbing and backcountry hiking and camping, and got really into that. And I was like, wow, I would probably be pretty good at that. And so just started doing it. And then 4 years later from that, then I went to graduate school. And then I was really excited and interested in climbing. And during my college years, it was mostly like trad climbing. So not much bouldering, mostly trad climbing. We would go to Zion, to Indian Creek is where I really learned to trad climb. And then we would go to the Valley in the summers as well.
And did you find that when you were, you know, in that academic stage, that you were looking at climbing and going, oh my goodness, there's so much potential here. They could go here, they could go there. Did it like just have this kind of light bulbs constantly going off you? Because I felt very similar when I first started looking at the academic literature.
Yeah, I mean, and it was really apparent in like the college setting in America. Like the University of Missouri is where like I did a lot of my master's work, and their university is huge. And if you look at the equipment that a college football team has in America compared to what climbing gyms have access to, it's profound in terms of like how much more access to knowledge and testing equipment they have that climbers just don't have access to. And so it's very stark, the difference there. So it's very obvious that there hasn't been a lot of utilization of those tools in a climbing context, primarily because they're expensive too, you know?
Mm. And when you talk about like, you know, like college football, for example, which is a really well-funded sport and it's been around for a very, very long time, can you give us some examples of what you mean when you say loads more knowledge and expertise and, you know, better tools? Like, what specifically are we talking about here?
Yeah, so like the University of Missouri is not the most dramatic, but the most dramatic would be like the Alabama, which is another big football team. And, you know, if you go into their weight room facility, they have a force plate at every squat rack. Those things are $10,000 to $20,000 a piece, right? And if you go to like the USA Ski Center up in Park City here, there's a same thing. There's a force plate at every squat rack. They have like a straight like blood lab in the facility, so they can do all the measuring, and they have all the VO2 max testing, and like they just have all the tools that are really define or identify the nuance with their training and how they can really optimize that training. And so in addition to the equipment, they need a staff and they need coaches that really are experts in those fields, right? Which is something that I was like, wow, I really want to learn about that, because, you know, and from my education, like the exercise science and the exercise physiology and the mechanics and the anatomy are really what I gained out of my education, and applying that to climbing has been something that I've been really interested in.
Mm. And do you think that if you were to take a lot of the tools and knowledge from these larger, I don't know what I would call them, broader sports, and put those things and those experts into the climbing world, do you think that they could, you know, metaphorically swim straight away and just bring so much to the climbing industry immediately? Or do you think that there's a process of understanding the complexities and the subtleties and the nuances of climbing when you apply back those sort of larger, more grounding, broad principles and equipment?
Yeah, I would say there's definitely some nuance to, you know, they would definitely need to learn to swim a little bit, right? Or they would sink. And that really comes to down to like the intensities of the loads. It's really hard to know that unless you do it yourself, right? Like I usually tell people I have a pretty good understanding, I think, of the anatomy and the physiology, but I would not be equipped to train a gymnast at a really high level because I don't really know how they train. I really just don't know all the subtle things that they have to go through day by day with their practices, aside from just some general things. So I think absolutely it needs to be, you know, applied in the context of having a much better understanding of the sport itself.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, that reminds me, quite a few years back, maybe like 4 or 5 years ago, I was doing some lecturing at a university here in the center of the UK. And it was with some consultant surgeons who sort of specialized in shoulder surgery. And I was showing them some videos of what climbers do when they dyno and catch holds and, you know, sort of, you know, one point of contact and their body swinging around. And I remember them coming up to me afterwards and just being utterly amazed that a human shoulder could even do that. They didn't even think it was really possible. And I always think, no, surely, these are the guys that are inside of the shoulder and they've seen the sports injuries and they would just take that for granted. But they were just amazed.
Yeah, I can only imagine if a hand surgeon that has nothing to do with climbing would look at what climbers do to their fingers. And you're like, it's incredible how resilient the hands really are. As common as I talk about hand pain and finger pain, which is the majority of what I do nowadays, like, and people have finger injuries, it's really, you take a step back and you look at it and you say, well, you've been hurt once in 10 years. Like, think of how much stress you've put on your fingers. Like, those tissues are so incredibly strong, you know? And so having that perspective, I think, is not really possible unless you've done all those things to yourself, but then also have the education behind, you know, some of the parameters of how the collagen actually becomes loaded and changes over time and all that kind of stuff. So it's definitely helpful.
Mm. And going back to this kind of idea or what I really want to kind of pull out for everyone listening is that I'd be interested to hear what you think are, I suppose, the advantages and disadvantages, or the things to look out for those of us of climbers who go and read papers or look at websites or approaches from other sports and try and bring those back into climbing. What are the things that you're looking out for and you think are important for people to understand, that you can't just go, this is this thing, I'm going to directly use it within climbing? I just looked at a hamstring and now I'm going to use it on the forearm, for example.
Yeah. So it's got to be like, you know, it's definitely muscle group and body weight or body part dependent, you know, with the studies. But I would say like reading systematic reviews are certainly the better option for people looking to like get information. And you can use, I think most of the applications could be for general lifting movements. Like a lot of those things, like deadlifting and pulling and pressing and all of those things, those could be transferred to the climbing athlete without a lot of change or manipulation. But when it comes to, I always think about the primary concern and or limiter is like the load to the finger pulleys. And, you know, really the stress that's the most problematic from my standpoint is all the grabbing and twisting that we do on the fingers. Cause you know, we're not really designed to do that. We're designed to grab onto things and then swing at the wrist, but we swing on our fingers quite a bit. And so I always that's my primary thought process when thinking about doing rehabilitation or programming for my athletes. And that's where a lot of the content that, at least regarding like fingerboarding and things that I apply to climbing, comes from that perspective, you know. But I like the idea of using the broader sense of literature in terms of more muscle contraction specificity. So like we use lots of isometrics on our fingers, obviously. So there's a whole broad of types of those that you can use that bigger sports have applied those concepts to. And I would say for the most part, the cool thing about the physiology is it can be muscle group dependent, but we can utilize a lot of the ideas and apply them to the fingers, even if they were done on the tricep muscle, which is an example I'm thinking of with isometric, you know, good research that's been done. So it's kind of hard to do for sure. And it's even hard for me to do as well. And I have a couple resources that I will use specifically individuals in that space that's what they do for their job. And I communicate with them a lot and, you know, talk to people like that about it too. It's hard to, you can't know everything. That's for damn sure.
Yeah. It's almost like the more you know, the more you realize you don't know.
No one knows, right? Or like, we don't really know, right? And so I think having that understanding and trying to learn as much as you possibly can, for me, gives people a little bit more flexibility with what they choose to do. And the more that I learn about physiology and loading, et cetera, the more I get away from a lot of the things that I used to do, just because there's a lot more options, which is kind of cool, because then people have less rigidity with their programming, right? Which I think is maybe problematic for most athletes, is we become really rigid with what we do.
Yeah. God, I mean, that's just half of just a human nature thing that people love, you know, familiarity. They like getting in a groove. They like routine and they don't like change. And
It's hard to change. And people, we want to see that linear progression of whatever it is we're training, but that's not really how the physiology works. You know, it's always this kind of ebb and flow or this give and take with the things that you do. And I usually tell my clients that at some point you have to back off, and backing off doesn't mean not climbing for weeks at a time, but backing off definitely means changing the way you're loading your tissues, you know, in a climbing context. And when it comes to prevention for injury stuff, that's, you know, the only reasonable answer. It's definitely not that there's some magic, you know, recipe out there for fingerboarding or something, you know, which is a bit misleading. So it can be misleading. It's confusing for people to try and just search polyandry and find out what to do, because it's not a simple answer, right? But you'll find a bunch of potentially simple answers, and then people are like, oh my God, I don't know what to do, because they don't always agree with each other. But because they don't agree with each other doesn't mean that they're not useful. It just means that they're different, you know? So that's super confusing.
And what's your view on the use of research or sort of sports science practice from taken from lower limb sports and then transferred into upper limb? Do you think that it's relevant? Do you think there are important differences when you look at those sort of, I suppose, the two, in air quotes, halves of the body? What's your thoughts on that?
When it comes to like things like tendon loading, you know, the majority of the research has been done on the Achilles and the knee and the patellar tendon, you know, and I think in practicality, like we can apply a lot of the same principles to the elbow and the shoulder, even though they don't undergo the same types of compressive loads as the patellar tendon and the Achilles tendon do. But, you know, in a more broader sense, you can take the idea that, you know, high amounts of mechanical load, which are usually done with strength training interventions, usually seem to be productive, but that's only really for athletes, where the majority of pain complaints that are compared with people that just do nothing or wait it out, they tend to get just as good of a resolution. But that's when it really needs to be applied to an individual athlete. So I would say in a broader sense, we can get a good understanding of it, but it's definitely not the same. You know, they definitely don't tolerate the same loads. They definitely, you know, can't tolerate the same amount of volume, you know, so there's definitely some nuance, you know, with comparing those two directly.
And do you think that's just simply down to our lifestyle activities, in the sense that in what we do as humans, our loading on the lower body is always higher than the upper body? So the history of what we've done through the duration of our life is by default of what our activities as a human is much higher on the lower body versus the upper body. So we have to kind of respect that when it goes forward in training, in the sense that like we don't go to school and swing on monkey bars from classroom to classroom and go out into the school playground and play catch all day long for 20 years in school, you know, that kind of concept.
Right. Yeah, for sure. I mean, we did, you know, millions of years ago, but certainly there's been changes to our body types as we've been more, you know, bipedal and upright. And so a lot of that load goes to the big, strong Achilles and patellar tendon. So yeah, there's absolutely a difference in just the regularity of the loading, but absolutely we're, in my perspective for climbers, is like, we, you know, our bodies are pretty well adapted and designed for that kind of stress. You know, but the shoulder has changed a lot compared to our, you know, ancestors or our closest relatives, right? Where now it's a little bit less optimal for swinging than it used to be, you know. And you know, I don't know if that's going down a strange rabbit hole, but ultimately, yeah, there's difference in mechanical load. Thus, the size of the tendons themselves and the muscles are different.
And something that I think will be a question, and I've been asked this by my own clients, and just when at work we're often just kind of chatting about the application of academia and theory into practice within sports and what we see on social media and things like that, is what's your personal timeline or approach with that? Here's academic knowledge or theory, and then there's that experimentation process where you go into those feedback loops of, how does this work? What's the feedback from the athlete or with multiple athletes, into now I'm going to deploy this into 10, 50, 100 clients. What does your timeline or process look like with that? And I ask this because I think pretty much every climber out there is constantly going through this thing of, I read something or I heard something, I should try this out myself. I think it'd be really cool to hear how your process looks.
Yeah, I usually try things on myself quite a bit, and hence why a lot of the things on my Instagram are seemingly random or novel, because like ideas, I don't think there's bad ideas necessarily. I don't know that there's even like, you know, there's definitely not bad exercises and there's definitely not bad ways to load. There's just a lot of different ways to load. And so being creative with those applications, I think is really cool. And I really like that idea. So I usually apply those things to myself and then a small group of people. And then once we see results with that, you know, and I think a lot of times too, just the simple variation can be useful for athletes, right? There's so many ways to do pull strength loading that just doing one is certainly not a productive way to gain adaptation long-term. Because if we think about our ancestors, they're doing random things every day, all day. And even though climbing movements are not the same, they're pretty much the same. There's a lot of common, you know, hands away from your face, pulling on the terrain styles of loading, right? So I think the variation also can be quite cool, but I tend to probably do things on myself for a training cycle, you know, and then that's why a lot of times we'll do these bench, like what are called bench studies, where I'll have climbers locally come in and we'll do some measuring and do some testing and then see what a group of people look like. And then that helps me kind of make broader decisions on, oh, this might be a good idea. But ultimately, we don't know until we try things for a long time. But the thing that's confusing is one, you know, the reason that all of those ideas out there, people are saying these things work, because they probably did for someone at some time, right? And so, like, just like the email, you know, thing that you got so many messages about, and I did too, it worked great. That doesn't mean that like everyone can do it and they're going to crush like their projects now. So it just, you know, it's way more complicated than just like applying a simple thing, you know?
Yeah. And we always want as practitioners to have some kind of, you know, overriding rule or method you can just use every single time of like 100% of people that you work with, because I mean, our lives would be a lot simpler if we could do that.
Oh, yeah, for the, sure.
Yeah, the reality of that, even from the sake of, you can have two climbers who have a very, very similar, you know, history, physiology, everything that looks similar to them. And you apply the same method in terms of their fingerboarding or their rehab for the same injury, and you get completely different results. And you kind of half pull your hair out thinking, I wish this could be the same, but also go, well, isn't this great that we can have multiple ways to arrive at the same endpoint? You just have to be prepared to try and experiment, which is why I think it comes back to this whole thing of experimentation is a good thing, even if you're not sure.
Oh, hell yeah, for sure. And I think coaches, you know, yourself and myself included, are harder on themselves than they need to be, because at some point you're like, we don't really know what we're doing, right? Like, it's this imposter syndrome idea where you're like, you know, everyone is so different. People don't respond the same to the things that we know work for this group of people. And so it can be really confusing. And for coaches that are relatively new to the climbing space, I can only imagine how much more stressful it is for them when they have athletes that either get injured or their clients are complaining they're not getting the gains that they expect, et cetera. Where that's kind of the reason why I've been interested lately in like measuring the length of the fingers with an ultrasound machine, just to see, because, you know, for me, when I do testing on myself, it's interesting to see that the forces aren't dramatically different between a bunch of different edges, right? And when I test a bunch of clients in my office, they get the same result. And so it's like, that's interesting, because a lot of the training things that we do, even though we don't think they have risks, there's always risks with any kind of loading. And so it's really about, you know, the dosage of that loading and how much an individual can tolerate. But that's different for every individual. That's different for every week, right? So that's when it gets like, there's so many things that you can't really account for. I think people in general knowing that being flexible is okay. Like, I like the idea of being flexible.
That kind of actually brings me almost perfectly onto the next question I was going to ask you about, all about loading. And I know that this is something that you're really interested in. It's probably the number one biggest addressed point that we work with all of our clients with as well, is how do you view load? Like, how do you just try and describe it to an individual that you're working with? And two, what do you think are the most practical ways for climbers to track and monitor load when it comes to their training or performance?
Load as in like total, like volume load, like fatigue load, or just like force?
Training load.
Training load. I have a lot of people use the ACWR. not sure if you've used that or are familiar with that metric, but it's a way that they can track their session duration, as well as their using just a perception of effort. But that becomes tricky, which is there's not a perfect model, obviously, but that becomes tricky because when we get tired, our perception of effort doesn't really match what's the central motor command for how much actual force we're producing during a movement. And so there's this like constant change in their load, but trying to be more thoughtful about how the perception of that load is going to change all the time. Like, it's really hard to manage the load. And when it comes to like finger training specifically, I personally don't do a lot of weighted added load work on my fingers. I use my climbing wall and progressively just do sets that are really hard that around, 50 to 60 seconds I'm failing. And you can track sets that way. So I have people track sets for distance as long as they're not compromising the intensity by making the edges bigger, during a phase. But I would say the load actually changes with the training phase, which, is, I don't know if that's answering your question directly. It's kind of a hard question, I think, like when it comes to specific, like, but if we wanted to do for myself, I use measure my velocity, which is a form of, my load, which is less fatiguing than doing a lot of like climbing volume. So ultimately it comes down to like how long the session is and how hard the athlete feels the session is, I think is one simple way to do it. But I don't know if that's a real direct measure of, the load on their physiology.
Mm-hmm. I think, probably what you're saying here is, and I think I would broadly agree, is that the measurement of load in climbing is still, again, like a lot of things, fairly individualized, and you've got to find a way that's appropriate for that individual to track or monitor load. Because yeah, just like, for example, for the perception of intensity or perception of effort, that can be so different across two individuals who are doing exactly the same thing with the same training history, because it comes down to, the individual's perception. And that's a mental thing. It's a psychological aspect. And that can vary hugely amongst two individuals. So I would always try and encourage an athlete or a coach to, like their training approaches, try a number of different methods for tracking or assessing load and find which works best given the situation. And you shouldn't be wedded to one particular method, like, RPE, just because you saw it in a great blog post or that's what you were taught at third year at university. You've got to experiment again.
Yeah, I think the other way I like doing it is like doing like just a regular like isometric testing load. And so one of the methods that I've talked about in the past about how you could do some form of maximum strength training on your fingers, just measure every rep, do your 10 second effort or your 7 second max and just measure the force, right? And that is one of those examples where you need the equipment that can do it. But there's now the cool thing about, with time going on, is that type of equipment is becoming more affordable, right? And so that's a really cool way to measure load, because even though their effort is very high, their physical force production is not very high. And so I think educating people about that, having people actually see that for themselves, can be really quite enlightening, because climbers don't need more effort. Like, climbers are generally people that do not lack in like trying hard. Like, climbers try hard. That's kind of like in our nature for some reason. But that doesn't necessarily mean that going to the gym and trying hard and trying harder every time is productive or a good idea. So being able to differentiate that, I think, is really important for people to see. And part of the reason I like using objective metrics with the testing is it lets them see that, so it's like you learn something by hearing it, but then you see it and you're like, well, that kind of makes sense, right? Giving them, I think, the visual a lot of times can be quite productive.
Mm. Have you noticed that, when you do the overhead dead hang testing and you're using a force plate, have you noticed that you get different scores from athletes? And this is talking about single arm pulling here, whether you allow the person to be more or less close to their threshold of where they can pull their body weight off the floor, or if you add a load of weight to them. So for example, if I have a 70 kg climber and they're able to just about pull their whole body weight off the floor with a single arm dead hang, if you measure that on a force plate, you might get a force of 68, 69, 70 kilos of force through that plate. But then if you add, say, 10 kilograms to their body weight to make sure they really do stay fixed to the floor, they can often only generate 65, 64 kilos of force. Have you noticed?
No, I have not. I haven't done a lot of unloaded testing, mostly because I have people kind of just locked down with their hips like in a squat rack, just because it's easy. But I have not really compared those two. But that would be interesting. I will now that you mentioned that.
Yeah, yeah. Have a look at it. We've noticed it just like time and time again now. So much so that we've had to do some work on our protocols for the digital testing to make sure that we're not heavily overly weighting climbers, basically, to make sure that we don't affect the results of it. It's a really interesting nuance with that digital testing that isn't, you wouldn't think would be obvious, but it definitely has an effect.
I mean, I know that we can definitely, I mean, when I do the ISO testing, I know climbers can hang more than the testing numbers show, obviously. And that's just from passive tension, you know, in tightening the connective tissues. That makes sense. So probably makes sense in that context as well. They're able to overload the passive structures more simply because it's more like an eccentric type of muscle contraction versus when they're pinned down, they're more concentrically pulling. So now that you described that, it makes sense for sure.
Mm-hmm. So moving away from fingerboarding specifically, and you know, talking about digital tools and things like that, and that experimentation curve, what do you, and I know that you work with climbers from all over the world and lots of different disciplines, you know, sport climbers, boulderers, trad climbers, what do you think are some of the common mistakes or concerns that you have with how climbers are climbing or training at the moment with their approaches? Are there any kind of broad patterns or messages that you see in the industry? And I suppose I asked it because I see things change from year to year.
Yeah, I would say probably the amount of indoor volume that we're doing. You know, it's so hard to, you know, have a season that's not, you're not going into an outdoor project kind of tired already from the indoor stuff because there's so much access now. You can climb whenever you want, right? And so it's really hard for people to appreciate that doing less is probably the answer, especially for people that are well-trained. You know, that's one of the mistakes that I've learned for myself is I train way less in terms of volume than I used to, and I've never been stronger, right? And so it's really hard when you don't have busy schedules, when, you know, kids are in college or just working and they live for climbing and all they want to do is climb more. You know, there's some value in that if it's outside, but if it's inside climbing and you're trying to apply that to outside climbing, it's just not the same, right? As close as we want to make it the same, it's not the same. And so I would say in general, keeping the overall training volume low, but then also making sure that you're modifying your training relatively, you know, often specific to the individual. And that's another mistake that I see a lot of times is people will do a strength training block, but they have a lot of climbing volume in their strength training block. And that doesn't make a lot of sense to me because the volume in that context has to be lower intensity. But strength training should be pretty high intensity, but it's got to be slower, right? And doing a lot of volume in that context reduces or makes more oxidative the strongest muscle fibers, which is maybe counterproductive for overall strength training. And so I think periodizing in some way their training programs obviously makes sense. But I think one of the things that I see a lot of is people just doing a ton of volume on the climbing wall inside during phases when it maybe doesn't make as much sense. And then in season, they're just getting really tired.
Mm. And do you think that's common across all disciplines within climbing, like sport climbing and bouldering and track climbing, et cetera? Or do you see a pattern in the groups?
Oh, probably. I mean, I hear when people are bouldering, I hear like during a strength training phase, if they are doing a strength training phase, they're still doing limit bouldering in a strength training phase. And to me, that doesn't make a lot of sense based on just the sheer volume of stuff that they're doing, you know, in terms of the rate of the force on the fingers. which is the power output on the wall. And then they're trying to put in a little bit of heavy, slow strength training, either in a gym, in a non-climbing gym setting, or on a fingerboard. But the sheer volume of stuff they're doing is still not strength focused, which I think is kind of confusing. And those athletes sometimes will do a lot of capacity stuff, which also is kind of the same thing. It doesn't make a ton of sense to me. Not that those interventions aren't a good idea, because they are, but maybe it's the timing at which they do them that doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. So I think, you know, that is one of the things that I've been talking about a lot on my channel. And I've seen a lot of value for myself as well. And during a strength training phase, doing most of my strength training work on the climbing wall. And I've seen no deficit to my strength, only like a maintenance of my peak strength by doing that. Right. And so I think a lot of ways we can keep it really simple for people, where, because all the finger training protocols out there work, and there's no doubt that they don't work. It's just which one is appropriate. And that's kind of back to the individual thing. It's a preference thing, but it's also trying lots of things and seeing, you know, which ones produce the results.
Mm-hmm. And would you say it's a similar approach that you see in things like, you know, athletics and college football, et cetera, that during their peak season, when they're on the field or in the stadium, that they're again keeping their strength work highly sport specific rather than adding in or doing too much of the general S&C work?
Yeah, for sure. They're definitely not, their coaches definitely aren't letting them go to the gym and lifting like to failure, doing sets to failure. That doesn't make any sense, because you can maintain all of that strength. And what I've been doing now is like kind of in season stuff. I've trained most of my finger, like especially for someone like yourself or people that have been climbing that long, finger strength maintenance is not hard to do in season, but you have to have either a really high velocity stimulus at a pretty modest to high intensity, or you have to do something that's really, really hard, but very short duration, and you won't lose any strength. But in season's not the best time to, in my opinion, apply a new finger training protocol, which is what a lot of people will do, because they're trying to like, they're making the assumption that their strength really is the limiter, where I would say, as you probably know, and your team, that people are probably stronger than they think they are. And a lot of the strength deficits that they see is because of the volume, the sheer volume of their training. And so they're not able to actually apply that strength adequately or at the right times because they're tired, you know, because they're going into a session tired, and that's where the effort becomes problematic.
Yeah. Or it's combined with that factor of movement efficiency. And just unable to move in the most efficient way on the wall, whether that's moving from a hold or moving to a hold. Both of those are very common issues. And I so commonly see it now where someone will say, I feel so weak on this problem or this move. And then you get to watch a video or a clip of them moving on the problem, and they are so slow and static and controlled throughout the movement. And you're thinking, well, it's no flipping surprise that you think that you're feeling relatively weak on it, because you're doing that V8 move or whatever it is in the manner that probably is the intensity of V10, 11 on the wall. So truly, your strength is not the issue here, even though they often can get duped into that feedback mechanism where they do the strength training, they get even stronger and they feel better on the move, but actually they haven't dealt with the efficiency factor.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that I see a lot of, and it's very obvious from learning about the physiology or understanding a little better, is the strength training stuff on a fingerboard, let's say, is not the same thing as trying hard on a hard boulder problem or a hard route, right? The forces are not the same. The rate is not the same. Like, it's not the same thing. So we shouldn't expect, I think a lot of people also put too much value in their finger training protocols, where it's not that they're not good. It's simply that we shouldn't really expect them to produce sports performance gains in like a direct way, because they're not that specific. Where football, you know, and other sports, they don't expect, they know that the strength training is like helpful, but that's mostly in the context of training to produce a lot more force or to load the tendon differently. But they know that the strongest athlete is not the best athlete. The athlete that can apply force quickly and shut the force off quickly and change direction more quickly is the better athlete. And so again, it's like back to finger strength training is good and important, but we put too much value on the actual things that we do, expecting them to make dramatic changes, when I think that kind of misses the point in a lot of ways.
I think one of the real services that you've done to the climbing community and the training in the industry as a whole has been really addressing and tackling this issue of speed and velocity when it comes to training and how this relates to performance. Because I think there was a period for a number of years where it just completely flew under the radar and people just saw strength is strength. Strength is power. Strength is elite levels of performance. And I think this has started to change significantly in the climbing industry, and perhaps helped somewhat by the indoor comp style, setting style, of a more sort of dynamic and powerful style. And, you know, people like yourself talking about this. What do you think are the sort of, I suppose, the go-to areas of the body physiologically that people should focus their attention on when it comes to the power aspect of training? Is it just the forearm flexor? Is it the lats? Is it the lower body? Like, where do you place that emphasis?
I would say it depends on the individual. For someone like a speed climber, they need it all. They need vertical pull, power output. They need hip extension, power output, all the way through ankle, plantar flexion. Like, they need to train more like a power lifter than anyone, probably. And I would not suggest that they train like a power lifter, obviously, because learning those movements is like the skill, and it's not worth learning the skill simply to become more powerful. You can become more powerful without that, but it requires people to really understand that the intent of the movement is really what differentiates it, you know, because we love to lift heavy things and try hard, and that's the effort part of the equation. But if you're not intentionally trying to move something really fast, you're not getting as good of an outcome. And there's been some cool papers, you know, about like those metrics showing that people can do less volume and they can maintain their strength, but they can also increase their power. But if the athlete doesn't intentionally move fast, they only get stronger, but they don't get more powerful. So I think it's part like, sure, the actual methodology that they use is really important, but just like the education of that alone is like, I think, really profound for athletes to use. But for most climbers, I would say vertical pulling for sure is something that's useful. I like doing the velocity-based testing and training for clients on doing fingertip pull-ups. I think that's an underappreciated exercise. And there's a climbing paper, can't exactly remember the author off the top of my head, that compared vertical, you know, pull-ups on a bar versus vertical pull-ups on a fingerboard, showing they're not the same thing. And vertical pull-ups on a fingerboard are probably more productive for a climber, but that's really phase specific and context specific, right? A lot of just climbers will hear, oh, sweet, fingertip pull-ups are better. I'm just only going to do fingertip pull-ups, right? That's not what I'm saying or what people are saying, right? So that's where it becomes hard, where it needs to be, you know, most of my like consults are talking about programming, because I think that's maybe the thing that people miss out the most, is understanding, you know, maybe why they should change what they're doing, you know. But I think pulling is obviously good. I like pressing, though. I'm a big proponent of bench pressing for climbers. Specifically, I like incline bench pressing for climbers. I think that's an underappreciated movement. But the velocity-based stuff, I think pretty much anything that we train as climbers makes good sense to also have some applications for velocity-based training too.
Yeah. You know, I'm a big fan of the push work as well, especially around the chest. We use it quite a lot at Lattice with our athletes, and I know I've kind of had sort of shaking heads or people just going, what, you have people doing that much bench work, or you have that people doing that much chest work? That's insane. Like, these guys aren't, you know, power lifters. They're not CrossFit bros. Why are they doing this? But it's really, really useful and relevant for climbers. And like, I even had it recently where I had a shoulder injury, which has caused me endless problems for like a year plus, completely doing my head in. And out of complete frustration in the end, I went, you know what? I'm just going to start to do planes of movement, which don't hurt this. And I'm just going to get way into the chest stuff. And probably within a month, I completely solved the whole thing. And it was just brilliant. And now I've kept it in my sort of general training regime. And I don't do loads in terms of like actually trying to get better, just like constant maintenance. And it's been flipping brilliant.
Right. I think that's another thing that's you brought up that's maybe subtle that people don't notice is, you know, with the lifting movements as a climber, we don't need to get really good at the lifting movements. Like, and the idea that we need to like learn to do it perfectly is like maybe missing the point. The whole point is to produce more force and to produce effort. But if we put too much value in that, then it takes away the primary reason we're using it in the first place, which is getting more efficient and using that force production on the climbing wall too. So it's also like, that's another thing that kind of like swinging back and forth with the climbing world is, oh, strength training is good. Great. I'm going to learn how to do perfect strength training and spend a lot of time and energy in that. That's probably not necessary. It's probably not that helpful in a lot of contexts, but yeah, you're describing exact perfectly. Produce more force in a muscle group in a movement that doesn't hurt. That's pretty much what rehab is. Pretty simple.
Yeah. I always remember it's something that I put on Instagram maybe 3 or 4 years ago where I was doing some bicep curl work. And I was doing like some max strength work, like down at like 2-3 rep max. And I got a load of people commenting on this little video that I put up going, oh, your lifting form is terrible. Dude, oh, yeah. you're going to get injured. This is a disaster. You're going to wreck your career and everything like this. And I always made me thinking, just as like a little reminder to everyone, what I do is relevant to my training history and my training history loads. And what I do is I respect that. And therefore, I do not have an issue when I'm doing things at my limit and maybe not with, in technically speaking, the most perfect form, because this is not the issue. It's load.
Right, right. The best way to get some shit is like do some partial range of motion pulling or pull-ups. People will flip out, right? And that's like one of the hard things about Instagram in general is, you know, we immediately want to make a judgment on what someone's doing without really understanding why the hell they're doing it in the first place. And it's really hard in 2200 characters to explain all that too. So Instagram is like a hard almost medium for communicating, but it's like quicker than writing a blog post about something, which can be really technical. So you try and consolidate things, you know, to have it be helpful. But yeah, that's always the case for anything, you know, video content for Instagram, which is kind of the downside, as everyone knows.
Yeah. I mean, that's I think where we're, you know, organizations like our own just have to stay true to the course that we believe in, sharing the knowledge and the education of people out there. And it's just being prepared to stand up and talk about the context of situations and that things have to be individualized and there aren't perfect answers or solutions to many of these things. And that's the nature of sport and training and human beings. We're not, you know, a car engine or some sort of mechanical device. That's also why coaching and training is somewhat complex.
Yeah, it's definitely complex for sure. I don't think athletes give it probably coaches enough, you know, like enough credit to how hard the job really is, you know, which yeah, there's no doubt, especially managing lots of different humans, you know, we all have different stresses in our life and adding on top of that, the complexity of work stress and stuff for an individual, the physiology just doesn't respond like the program, unfortunately.
Yeah, I definitely learned that one during COVID and lockdown, that I had so much like stress that suddenly training was not very productive.
Yeah, and everyone got hurt. Well, not everyone, but lots of people got hurt like for during that, because lots of time, new things to do, you know, having fun. And again, but when people get hurt in that context, it's not that they probably really hurt themselves or that the things they were doing were really bad. It's just the dosage of those things just superseded the capacity of the system at that time. So you get some sort of pain complaint. But the cool thing about pain is it's really flexible. And it's not a good representation of what's going on at the tissue level all the time, you know? And so pain complaints, you know, can be considered less like scary as they really feel. And I know this from my experience. I've had lots of low back pain since I was in my 20s, and it's always different. It always has a different presentation in terms of where it is. It always goes away at a different time frame. It's a shit show, to say the least, right? But I know that it's going to go away. And so when it comes to athletes that have pain complaints, you know, priority number one is knowing that it's going to go away and being patient, but you have to modify stuff too. And that's another, like, I mean, maybe not on this exact topic, but when it comes to rehab, you know, errors that people make, I would say the number one problem is they don't modify their normal climbing behaviors. The normal climbing behavior is there, but they usually do less intensity, which means they just climb easier stuff. But then they can just do way more of those behaviors, which is not helpful for a pain complaint, especially for shoulder, elbow, and finger injuries.
Mm-hmm. And do you often find that, and I think I've definitely got a view on this, is that often when people get into a situation where they have an injury or they have pain, that they don't spend enough time being really diligent about looking at what were the habits and behaviors that led up to that point. So like, what did your climbing and your lifestyle look like in the month, the 2, the 3 months beforehand? And are you making some kind of change in that now that you're trying to deal with the problem? Or are you just basically, yeah, as you said, like producing a mirror image of that exact same thing, but all you did was drop the volume?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I do every day, all day, for the most part now for work, is talk to people about what their loading habits look like leading up to some sort of irritation. And that kind of spurred some of the research on the finger, just looking at the length of the fingers, because what happens now is there's a lot of coaches that are trying to help people, but maybe they don't have the nuance of, you know, kind of what me and you have been talking about, of differentiating or choosing between those, and they become really rigid with their prescriptions. And then you have a 5'11 climber who boulders V4 at the gym doing 10 millimeter edge hangs. And you're like, wait, why? Why are you doing that? Like, so that absolutely is like the most important thing, I would say, when it comes to doing a rehabilitation program for someone, is maybe giving them a little bit more flexibility and a little bit more comfort and, like, you know, understanding that they can modify what they're doing. And, you know, in the long term, it's not going to really change the outcome for the most part, other than it should be more helpful in terms of not, you know, not being as risky in terms of the edge size. But yes, that's so important.
Mm. And talking of rehab, I know that the tools that you use, so like the actual physical tools in your hands, may not matter per se, you know, things like frequency, volume, diet, lifestyle habits, etc., as being really the key. But I'd love to hear what tools you rate or don't rate in terms of rehab, that are like your go-tos that you've got sat in your gym and you really like using yourself or with your clients. Because I know that, you know, lots of listeners are always interested in hearing, like, what are the things that, you know, experts in the field actually think are pretty good tools to buy or to borrow or beg off people?
Yeah, I think I'm a pretty recently less so vocal opponent to rehab toys, right? Because, like, when it comes to the connective tissue, like, it's so strong, and it's so strong that it's very unlikely to make any sort of change in the short term. Like, most climbers know that, you know, tendons don't change for quite some time. Your tendons aren't going to get stronger for a while. And so we can't go into an injury with a different perspective and say, okay, now you're injured, now we're going to hurry up that process. That just doesn't make any sense. And so I would say the number one tool for a finger injury, let's say, is a fingerboard, right? Like, that is as simple and as complex as it needs to be, in my opinion, because a lot of the motions that we use or that maybe are prescribed, we do all day long. Like, I do all those, I type all day long on my computer. Like, I'm doing plenty of motion in my finger. A lot of times the downside of those implementation of those things is it serves as a reminder that something's wrong with the finger. And it just gives you something to fidget and be anxious about all day long. You know, so I don't use any of those tools and or prescribe any of those tools, with the exception of pulley splints when they're needed, right? Maybe tape when someone's coming back from a pulley rupture and they need to tape their finger to get on the wall. And obviously the splint with pulley ruptures, but I would say 90% of the time, I don't prescribe any extra tools other than making sure they're managing the other things in their life and using a fingerboard regularly. I think it's as simple as it needs to be.
Mm. Well, there you go.
As complicated as it needs to be.
Yeah, you heard it here. I like things like this when I speak to people like you and you go, you know what? It can be pretty blooming simple, because I think climbers, especially the ones that are really, really into their sport and just totally obsessed with their own journeys and things, get so far down these rabbit holes of thinking that like some new thing that they saw is the answer to their problem. Whereas often, like, you've got to go back to pretty simple basics, and that's where you should be focusing your attention. A bit like when people obsess about some funky new protocol for finger strength work, for example, and they think that's the answer, and you're like, it's not. Just keep it relatively simple and it'll work.
Yeah. And I come at that from like a space of doing those things. Like, I've done those things. I've poked needles at people's fingers and I've used those tools to scrape at their fingers. But as I like, I'm not someone, even though it maybe seems like I accept new things pretty quickly, like I'm someone that's pretty hesitant and be like, I don't know, that kind of looks silly before I implement those things. So when it comes to like, I've done those with clients before and noticed that they don't really make any change, right? They don't really speed up the healing process. And the science would be pretty solid that they're changing pain perception. That's it, right? If you want to like, you know, change your pain perception, man, do it on your own, save yourself some money and do it on your own. That's pretty easy to do, but it's not nearly as effective as teaching someone, sitting down and actually asking someone about what the hell they do with their life every day and how they can modify those things, and to, as best you can, try and connect with them and convince them that being patient is a really important thing at that particular moment, right? And that's the hard thing, is we're all anxious to do stuff and we all want to go send because the weather's good, and being patient is the hardest thing you can do.
Yeah, I always tell the really good athletes, especially ones that want to have like a long career in it, is make sure you have a sideline hobby to climbing that will occupy you and keep your brain motivated and happy outside of climbing, because I assure you there will be 1 to 5 fairly significant injuries that you will face in your career, and you've got to have something that you can step out to whilst you deal with it, because you'll drive yourself mad.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just posting this morning as well. One of the other mistakes I would say I see a lot is people, when they have a pain complaint, let's say for a month, they just don't climb for a month with a finger injury that's not a pop. I think that's a mistake too, because taking an athlete and removing them from something that's so valuable to their identity is more stressful. And we know that the psychological stress is a really strong influencer of pain. And so when you take an athlete and say, don't climb, that's not helpful, right? And so I also like the perspective that the fingers are meant to be loaded, and there's so much healthy stuff, so much more healthy stuff than injured stuff, right? And so that's, again, another, you have to modify the behavior of what they're doing. And most of the time, people tolerate that very well. And it's just like, you know, using, if you could think about using the wall like a fingerboard, now the wall is your rehab, right? But it's not easy climbing. It's different, right? So it's like subtle, but I think that's been really helpful for my clients recently. Within the last year and a half, I've been doing that a lot with people, and it works really well, but it gives them their identity still, which I think is really important.
Mm-hmm. And last thing that I wanted to ask you about today was, and I suppose this goes back a little bit to also some of the context and experience that you have from outside the climbing industry as well, is where do you think are the most interesting areas for development in our sport in terms of, you know, rehab, training, peak performance at the moment? Like, what are you excited about over the coming, I don't know, let's say 5 years? What things pique your interest where you go, we're going to see lots of development here, this is amazing? I'd love to hear about that.
I'm really interested in finger edge size training. I'm interested in that. And I know there's some papers that have come out recently that are good about that are saying maybe for the strength work, we use a different edge, and maybe for the specific stuff, we use this edge. Like, I think that's going to change. I like that idea. I'm a big proponent of the velocity-based training and people maybe using a campus board a little bit with a little bit more nuance for a reason, not just doing things where the velocity deficit, where if people aren't familiar with that, is actually measuring a power output. Like, I think there's massive value there because a lot of times we're just getting tired at the gym, right? And getting tired at the gym is not a good way for your physiology to adapt and change. That's interesting. And with the SMO2 stuff, I'm interested in that as well. That is a bit more confusing, I think, for everyone that's using it. There's quite a bit of moving parts, and there's a lot of individual variation there as well. But I think in general, the methodologies for training, I think, will hopefully change a little bit, where like a speed climber needs their training needs to look different than a bouldering athlete's training does, different than a sport climber's training. So I think this, right now, a lot of people use a lot of the same things, where that to me doesn't make a lot of sense. So I think we'll see more dispersion there as, the Olympics don't have all of those events clumped together.
For sure. I think I very much agree. And I suppose in some ways we've seen that over the sport of climbing in the last 50 years, that it just slowly fragments down into these areas and then a sub niche and a sub niche, and everyone develops and understands the number way to perform and excel in that particular sub niche of the sport that they go down. And it's fascinating. I love it.
Yeah.
Just like the coolest problem to spend all your time trying to solve and think about and then apply to individuals. It's like the best job in the world, really.
mean, well, it makes sense too from another sport. Like, the sprinters are not the long distance runners. Like, it's not like anyone that runs knows that, right? It's like, why should we expect a really high level boulder to do a really hard sport climb? It just doesn't make any sense in a lot of ways. It's very hard. It's not fair for the athletes, really, in my opinion, because it's like it gives them a good broad, range, but like it's okay to specialize. I like the idea of specializing if people really want to, right? And this idea that everyone needs to be very broad, general in terms of their climbing is like that's up to a preference, right? It's like everyone's own climbing journey. I like the idea of people choosing that for themselves. That definitely changes training.
Well, Tyler, thanks, so much for getting on a Zoom call with me this afternoon to record a podcast for everyone listening. I hope all of you listening have really enjoyed this chat with me and Tyler. He does, it's just I always like seeing your content, wherever you put it out, and I know that people listening will also want to look up some of this. I'm sure probably most of our listeners already follow your stuff, but can you just give people some signposts of where they can find more from you if they are listening and haven't yet followed what you're doing?
Yeah, probably the easiest way is just through Instagram, through my account C4HP. And then there's a website where I have, I do a good amount of traveling and teaching, and then there's some online courses as well that if people are interested in more content, but that Instagram page will have links to my website too. So that's the majority of the space. I'm trying to be more to expand a bit more and use YouTube more and stuff, but for the most part, it's been, me and now I have a couple coaches that are helping me that we're going to try and put out more stuff like that. But as you know, it's just requires a whole bunch of people, which I don't have a whole team of people. So it's like I don't have time to do that.
We'll put all the links to Tyler's social channels in the show notes below, and also to his website and everything like that. So go and check out those links and you'll find more from Tyler. But otherwise, thanks so much again for chatting. Always love this, and I'm sure we'll connect up again pretty soon because we've always got plenty to talk about.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity, man. Appreciate it.